Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Mars. Sexual harassment and abuse in the workplace have dominated the headlines in recent weeks. One of our panelists on today's Legal Roundtable says Missouri may not be positioned well to deal with workplace sexual predators. That's Donna Harper of the Sade Harper Westhoff Law Firm. She is a specialist in workplace rights. And she joins our regular attorney panelist Bill Freivogel, who teaches journalism at SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor and Dean for Career Services at Washington University. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Donna, nice to have you back again. We'll start with you, if I may. Why don't you tell our audience who have not read your piece in the Post a few weeks ago, what the gist of that was?
Well, the gist of it is that up until this past summer, the Missouri Human Rights Act, which is our state law equivalent to the federal law against discrimination on the workplace, Title VII, up until this summer, that state law protected individuals because it allowed them to bring a lawsuit, a claim, against somebody who sexually harassed them on the job. A boss, a manager, somebody in authority at the company could be named in the lawsuit. The legislature amended the statute and took out that provision, basically amended the definition of who is an employer, took individuals out. So what it means now is a sexual predator can harass women on the job, young women in fast food service companies, women who work anywhere, hotels, in sales jobs, sales reps, women all over the state can be sexually harassed. They cannot bring a claim against the man who did it to them, and he'll never be named anywhere. So you as an employer are never going to know that you're hiring somebody who in the past has had these kinds of allegations made against him. And he can just go blithely from job to job, and both the employer's at risk, and of course the employees are at risk. They amended the statute and just took it out.
What was the rationale for that, do you know?
I can tell you what I think the reason is. Sure. I think the reason is that employers have decided that we ought to be in Missouri more like the federal law. The federal law a long time ago decided that you can't sue individuals, federal courts. But Missouri's law has always been broader and offered more protection than federal law. And these employers didn't want the uncertainty that comes with being able to name the individual, and that what it really meant was that an individual person can bring a claim in state court, and they like federal court better, so they want to amend the statute to keep these claims out of state court, where people are likely to get to a jury to hear the issue.
Because of this change, it's going to be much more difficult for plaintiffs to stay in state court, because if you have an employee suing a corporation that's headquartered in Delaware or something, you have diversity jurisdiction, which would allow you to take a state claim and then move it into federal court. But if you have named an individual employee who's also a state of resident of the state of Missouri, then you don't have what's known as complete diversity. And so you would not be able to remove it to federal court. So in the old days, it would be harder to get it to federal court. Now it's going to be easier, and a lot of employers like federal court.
Right. Employers like federal court because there's summary judgment practice in federal court. A huge number of these employment discrimination claims are dismissed before they ever get to a jury when they're filed in federal court. It also, though, I'll tell you, it's unfair to Missouri employers, because if you're an employer who's incorporated here in Missouri, You know, the claims can still be brought against you, the Missouri employer, in Missouri state courts, and Missouri juries can still hear that. But the big companies and the ones that incorporated somewhere else are off the hook. They go to federal court. They'll remove that case from state court, dump it in federal court, and then you've got the whole idea that you'll not likely get to a jury. Very, very few of these cases are tried in federal court. You can look at the numbers. Very few.
So, Don, you asked, why. So what was the Missouri legislature rationalization? And the Republicans said, you know, what Donna said about making it like the federal law, but also they said this is a way to lure corporations to Missouri. So, that's pretty crude to think about making, people's victims of discrimination and harassment their lives more difficult so that we can get more big corporations in Missouri.
We should point out that this action taken by the legislature really occurred before this spate of cases, before Harvey Weinstein opened the Pandora's box.
Well, it certainly occurred before the news of Harvey Weinstein.
Got it.
But it certainly did not occur before all of his misbehavior and other people's misbehavior, obviously.
Well, and the other big change in this law that we haven't talked about here, but we've talked about before, is changing the standard what the level, whether it's a motivating factor, I think that's the term, or before just a factor, and the NAACP, part of their boycott call was primarily because of this change in the legislation and the statute and this change in the and the standard.
So what Mark's talking about is the fact that a jury is instructed at the end of the case, what do you have to find in order to prove, in order to say that an employer is guilty or not guilty. Mm-hmm. And the Missouri instructions up until the statute was amended said if somebody's race or age or sex played a part, any part in the decision is unlawful. You can't consider a person's age or sex or religion or race. Now the legislature, it says, no, it has to be a motivating factor in the decision. If it's tainted by discrimination, that's not enough. It has to be a motivating factor. And that's it's a higher burden of proof on the plaintiff.
How many of these kinds of cases, Donna, have you handled and represented clients?
In my lifetime, I've been a lawyer since 1979, so thousands.
Thousands of them.
Not trials, but how many people?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to thousands. Get to, because you indicated that not many of them do go to trial.
Well, I just looked at the report on the number of trials in the Eastern District of Missouri Federal Court, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's not very many, a couple dozen civil trials,
but
maybe
some
three
of
dozen.
Them settle, right?
Oh, a lot of them settle.
Because
yeah.
I used
dismissed.
To do this on the defendant side. And, you know, for our clients would, if there was something where they thought, this doesn't look good for us, we don't want to take it to the jury, let's see if we can settle this case. Plus, business people like certainty, and they don't like to pay attorneys for going to trial. It's expensive. So, yeah, it was rare to see things, although we had some clients who took the position, we're never settling. We're going to fight every one of these. I don't think that happens as much anymore, but I don't know. I've been out of it.
When it comes to sexual harassment, though, I mean, almost always, it's a he said, she said kind of situation. These are really unprovable allegations, aren't they?
Well, that's why you have a jury.
Yeah.
The jury system is the foundation of our jurisprudence in the United States, and a jury gets to decide, do they believe the claims or do they believe the defenses? And that's where the uncertainty that Mark is talking about comes into play. Businesses don't want the uncertainty of 12 people from the community deciding who told the truth and who didn't tell the truth. In the system that we have now under Title VII, There's a huge number of cases are dismissed on summary judgment. Another huge number are settled, and then some tiny little number go to trial. That's not true in state court. In state court, cases are not dismissed on summary judgment because the judges have been instructed by the Missouri Supreme Court that these cases are the kind of cases where the facts all need to be developed and the jury needs to decide on the basis of all the facts that they've heard, what the truth is. But that's now been sharply curtailed, if not completely eliminated in some instances.
And Don, on these sex harassment cases, there are two kinds of sex harassment cases. There's what's known as the quid pro quo, where you have to have a supervisor. Mm-hmm. And basically the supervisor says to an underling, you know, have sex with me and I promote you. You know, that's the quid pro quo. But then there's hostile work environment cases. And that can be a coworker, it can even be the Xerox guy that comes in and fix the equipment. And they say things to an employee because of that employee's sex. And they're oftentimes sexual, but it might just be there. You know, I remember cases where it was the first woman on the repair crew that would go out. And these men were just doing really mean things to her, not trying to get her to have sex with them, but to just, because they didn't like the fact that a woman was on the workforce, and they would, there also oftentimes were sexual overtones to it, but it might be, you know, breaking her equipment or putting stuff in her, you know, stealing her lunch, things like that. I mean, much more severe than that, though.
So that's part of the loose language that we have when it comes to matters of harassment because of sex, sexual harassment, sexual assault. The harassment because of sex has always been illegal. What Mark just described, picking on a woman because of her sex, making, you know, wrecking her truck, doing things that make it impossible for her to get her job done, and so she ends up getting fired. That kind of harassment's always been illegal. The sexual harassment really was only recognized as a cause of action with the Vinson versus Meritor State Bank case, and I think that was back in 1980, someplace
late
in
80s,
there.
I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
86, maybe?
87.
Okay. Yeah. So that was the Supreme Court case that said that, you know, sexual harassment is also something that the law reaches and that it's also unlawful. And the quid pro quo stuff, that's what comes from a supervisor or a manager. But the hostile environment, a supervisor can create it.
Right.
Coworkers can create it. Customers can create it. And, you know, anybody can create that environment. The big difficulty with that is most women don't report it. And they don't report it because they don't believe that there's an effective mechanism to deal with it, and they are afraid of retaliation.
What I really hope is that the country's attention remains on this long enough to actually change some of the laws that need to be changed at the federal and the state and in Congress. So Title VII needs to be to enable broader kinds of lawsuits, ones that don't get thrown out before trial, as most of them do now. Missouri, as we just talked about, you know, needs to go back to the tougher discrimination law that enabled you to name the sexual predator who was taking these actions against women. And in Congress, I mean, this Office of Compliance, where public money is spent, to pay for the transgressions and assaults of members of Congress. I mean, that is Office of Compliance. I guess that's supposed to be complying with the make Congress comply with the law, but it sounds like it's trying to make women compliant because the women who are the victims of that have to wait 90 days before they can even, 90 days of mediation and counseling before they can even move ahead with a formal action. Yeah. So all that needs to be changed, and it's going to require the country to sustain the interest that we've had for about a month.
There's some irony in the fact that Congress ought to do something, given the number of people in Congress who have been tainted by this. I have to take a break. I'd like to pick up on one of your points, Bill, when we come back. We'll do that in just a moment. This is Legal Roundtable Day. With me in studio, our attorneys, Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Donna Harper. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with attorneys Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Donna Harper. Bill, let me come back to you at this point. Matt Damon, of all people, a movie star, has been getting some criticism because he is talking about creating a spectrum of behavior. You're talking about laws to deal with these situations. What he wants is, he says some of these issues are not as serious as others. Harvey Weinstein is a little bit different than somebody just patting a woman on the backside.
Yeah, I thought the problem with what he said was not so much that there are different gradations of seriousness, which, you know, there clearly are, but that some way on the lower end of the spectrum that was maybe like okay and we shouldn't make a big deal out of it. I mean, he tried to back away from that. That's not what he meant, but it sort of came across that way to me and to a number of the movie actresses. I mean, you know, clearly the things that Roy Moore was accused of doing, you know, and that involving people who are really children, I mean, you know, that's worse. than some of them say what Bill Clinton was accused of doing, of having, as bad as that was, having a relationship with an intern.
Yeah. Donna, what do you think? Is a spectrum of behavior something that makes any sense at all?
Well, I didn't read the Matt Damon article, so I'm not responding to that. But I will tell you, one of the very first cases I ever had that almost went to trial involved a man who was a bar and restaurant manager, and his behaviors vis-a-vis college students who worked both in the bar and in the restaurant as servers and whatnot. And I had an expert witness to try to explain the whole issue of sexual harassment, because this was very early in my career. And she talked specifically about a spectrum of behaviors and how it escalates if it's not stopped. So that's one of the things the Supreme Court said was, you know, they created this whole idea that you should have to report, which isn't in the statute. And they created this whole idea that it has to be severe and pervasive harassment that affects a working condition. They wanted this ability, this obligation to report hostile work environment so that the employer could do something about it. But again, it depends on whether in reporting it, the woman has, or the whoever it is, man or woman, has any confidence that the employer will do anything about it. And because when they get these reports and they resolve them one way or the other, it's all confidential, employees can never have any confidence that anything's really happening. So we've created this big overblown artificial structure that obviously hasn't worked to end sexual harassment or even to curb it in the workforce. So something needs to change.
We have a caller who wants to get in on this part of the conversation, then we'll move on, although there's one other case I want to bring to our attention here. But let's bring in Ron calling from St. Louis. Ron, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
I had a question. I was wondering, has the payments for racial and sexual discrimination changed, or are they about the same? Are they, I know there's been moves to lower the amount of awards, and I also want to say that racial discrimination seems to be much more prevalent than sexual discrimination. It has a much more effect on the income of those in our community that are not being hired or not being promoted on jobs in throughout the United States.
Was your first question concerning payments? Was that the word?
I think he's talking about damages for lawsuits.
Yeah, but I wanted to be sure that was, Okay, thanks, Ron, for the call.
Sorry about that.
What about this issue of payment?
You mean jury verdicts? I mean, jury verdicts.
I guess so.
Yeah. Jury verdicts for discrimination cases are all fact dependent. It depends on what the allegations are, what the jury believes, what part of the state the jury's in, whether it's a state jury or a federal jury. It's very hard to respond to his question authoritatively. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that racial discrimination cases are get to a jury with even less frequency than sexual harassment cases, in my experience. Yeah.
And wasn't there a change in the Missouri law that limited damages as well?
Yes. Missouri capped the damages when they amended the law to let individual harassers off the hook. They also capped the damages, and the rationale was to make the damages like the federal damages, which are now, I guess, 1991. They are, I don't know, almost 30 years old.
What's the cap?
The caps are $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, and $300,000, depending on the size of the employer.
Yeah, those are like almost like punitive damages. Are those total caps on actual damages?
Those are caps on compensatory and punitive combined.
And can you still get attorney's fees?
You can still get attorney's fees under both federal and state law.
And that's a little different. Like if I sue you, you know, if you just hit me in the head and I sue you for a tort damage, I wouldn't typically be able to get attorney's fees. Mm-hmm. And so this is a little, this is one of the things that's a little different, although it's not a huge difference. Right. And obviously it only works if you win. If you lose, then you don't get your attorney's fees.
I mean, one thing I'd just like to make clear, and this sort of goes to that elections have consequences, that, you know, the Republicans were trying to water down the human rights law in Missouri for a decade or more, and it was vetoed every time by Democratic governor, and now we have a Republican governor right. who did not veto it, but signed it and ballyhooed it.
The one other case I wanted to bring to everyone's attention was this Judge Kaczynski with the Ninth Circuit out in California, who I think was this morning or late yesterday announced that he was retiring after allegations were made against him that he would bring young clerks or interns into his office, lock the door, and show them pornographic material on his computer or whatever. Well, he's a judge, and they do an awful lot behind closed doors. But what do you make of that? I know you know something about this particular judge.
Yeah, well, Judge Kaczynski is one of the most famous federal appeals court judges. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and he's very brilliant. He has long had a pipeline of sending his top clerks onto U.S. Supreme Court clerks, which is sort of like the highest. You know, that's a great job for a lawyer. And he's outlandish. He likes to say things that are blunt. I mean, in his retirement statement, he said, you know, I just have a great sense, a big sense of humor, and I talk candidly to women and men who are my clerks, and gee, I'm really sorry that I was the way I spoke, and that people were hurt by that. So you know, not it's another one of those sort of non-apology apologies. You know, it just shows that I mean he'd be the kind of guy who would fight something. So so I think it just shows that incredible pressure that I think is really good for people to resign quickly. You know, sometimes people say, well, these guys aren't getting due process. Well, due process is something for the courts. You know, due process isn't something that you necessarily get from stories that are in the press about what you've done.
Well, a lot of them are voluntarily resigning, just right. as the judge yeah. has. I mean, they're not going anywhere except leaving whatever job they have.
I guess his pension will probably still be pretty good, though.
No doubt.
For sure. You know, this just illustrates, though, these rumors about this particular judge, these stories were fairly well known as I'm reading it. They were fairly well known in the law schools that placed the lawyers to be clerks with this judge. There were stories told from one law clerk to the other how to avoid situations with mm-hmm. this judge. And nobody could come forward because here's somebody who is in such an incredible position of power. You know, one word from this judge and your legal career is ruined. You don't have an opportunity. So who's going to report? And it's the same thing that plays out in the workplace. This obligation to report when there's no confidence that anything will come of it other than retaliation is a huge part of the problem.
Because it almost always deals with someone in a position of power.
Yes.
That seems to be the key to just about all the cases that we've been
yeah.
reading about.
Right.
Anything else to add? You were talking about human resources and the problem that these people have.
Yeah, I mean, the obligation of the employee in a hostile work environment case is to make sure the employer knows what's going on, and they tell human resources. And now you've got human resources who's supposed to be investigating and who's supposed to be looking into all these allegations. Well, typically what I see is you've got some high-producing, high-income man, and you've got some new sales rep right out of college or some new, pretty much younger woman. And when HR is looking into this, you know, they always will find that it's a he said, she said. They're not going to fire the guy who's making hundreds of millions of dollars or even tens of thousands of dollars. And they don't tell the employee what they've done. And here's the woman who made the report who has to come right back into that situation. And maybe HR has said to him, look, if this is true, cut it out. I don't want to hear any more reports. You better not do this. Maybe they've said that, or maybe they don't have that much power in the organizations themselves. They're between kind of a rock and a hard place. But in the end, that young woman who made the report or that middle-aged woman who made that report has to go right back into that work environment. And there are lots of ways to make work miserable without rising to the level of cognizable retaliation that you could tell a court about.
Is there a statute of limitations in sexual harassment cases?
180 days under state law, 300 days under federal law. That's to file a charge. Under state law, 2 years to bring a lawsuit. Under federal law, there isn't really a particular time to bring a lawsuit. Once you get the notice that says you can bring a lawsuit, you got 90 days to find a lawyer who will take the case and file a lawsuit.
But you got to go to the, this is kind of unusual too, Don, you got to go to the EEOC or the Missouri Commission on Human Rights or what's the group at CREA in the city, right? And then you have to wait, what is it, 180 days before you get to write the sue letter, and then you get to go to federal court. So it, there's a lot of hoops to jump through.
We have a caller that wants to get in on the HR discussion. We'll bring in Brittany, then we'll move on. Brittany, thanks for coming in. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering, so when HR is made aware of an issue with, say, a manager and then a subordinate, and the issue is kind of resolved, but it really, it results in the manager just kind of going to another company, are they, is HR responsible for, I guess, telling the new employer what the manager's done?
Short answer to that is no. A longer answer is that if HR has an opinion about that new manager and what he's done and tells a new employer, the if the manager finds out and has been harmed, he could actually sue the employer for defamation if he can prove it's not true and that he was harmed. So, you know, I don't know if this happens very often, that the manager is sort of ratted out to the new employer, but I do know that most employers have make it a policy to say to a new employer who's looking at a prospective employee only, he worked here, he was in this job, here's the dates he worked here, and if you give permission, here's what he earned. They won't say anything else.
They just do what the service letter statute says, right?
And that's the big deal about the amendment to the Missouri Human Rights Act, because you could name the person before the law was amended, and the new employer wouldn't have to call up, and the old employer wouldn't have to fear a lawsuit for defamation. There'd be a court record, you could look at it, and it would be available to you.
I wonder if this spate of cases is going to cause the Missouri legislature to reconsider that action. We shall see.
I doubt it.
Right. Okay, let's move on. Unless someone has anything else to add on this particular subject, we will move on. Missouri Court of Appeals has ruled against a grand juror in the Darren Wilson case. Wilson, of course, is the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown. The juror petitioned wanting to speak out about the process of the grand jury. In a unanimous ruling, the court said no. Does this unanimous ruling tell us something? This is a case we've talked about before.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting opinion. And, you know, but what the court basically says is that this grand juror could still do what the grand juror says. It's always referred to as a she. I guess it's a she. What she wants to do, and that is, you know, she's been saying that she wants to talk about, sort of educate the public and to correct misunderstandings perpetrated by McCullough in his press conference the night the grand jury action was announced. And the court is saying, you know, Missouri courts don't have to issue a declaratory judgment keeping the law from being enforced against this grand juror, the grand jury secrecy law, because the grand juror could go out and accomplish much of what she says she wants to do without having that law put on hold. So the ACLU, who has been defending her, says they're going to go to the Missouri Supreme Court. And, you know, maybe they will have some success. And they also have the, at some point, potentially the ability to go back to federal court. I mean, this thing started in federal court, then it got knocked over to state court, so the state courts could interpret their own state laws. So there are other, this can continue on. But I wonder if at some point, you know, will this, maybe the ACLU will advise this grand juror to go make a public statement as specific as she can. I mean, one thing that she claimed was that, well, McCullough said that McCullough implied that all members of the grand jury agreed not to indict Wilson, and but that's not what McCullough said.
Would this be a good thing in general to have grand jurors available to talk about what went on behind those closed doors? Just the issue of transparency comes to mind.
Good yeah, but thing, they're trying thing. To they're trying to protect, you know. So if there is any something brought against me, so I'm a potential defendant, and the grand jury decides not to, you know, give me a bill to go forward. But then you can talk about it. Well, they were talking about Mark Smith did this and Mark Smith did that. So part of it is trying to protect me, not just these grand jurors. There also was some, when I looked at that Court of Appeals, there was some suggestion. She was wanted to talk about how this grand jury was different from all the ones before. So some suggestion she's going to be talking about these other grand juries as well. And so other people's rights might be implicated. So I agree with Bill. I think we have not seen the end of this. I think there's probably an appeal in the works. Also, you got the federal courts waiting out there because they've talked about First Amendment rights under the federal Constitution. And while the Missouri courts have said, well, the Missouri rights are at least as broad as that, so we can deal with it, you still get a crack at the federal courts. And there's this wild card of maybe she just decides to do it and see what happens. And so I think this... We'll be talking about this again.
I mean, it seems like she can definitely make statements about the grand jury process that will not necessarily get her prosecuted, you know, as long as she doesn't get into stuff like, you know, these were the witnesses who appeared and this was the vote of the grand jury and things of that sort. You know, the grand jury secrecy is actually it's the Civil Liberties Protection, actually. You know, it's to keep the accused, if a person who is accused, as it turns out, maybe falsely, of a crime, for not everything, for that not to all become public. So it's actually to protect the reputation of a person who might have been falsely accused. So I mean, sometimes we need to see it from that point of view as well.
And it seems to me that the opinion does give this grand juror some flexibility, gives her some guidance on what she can do, and is particularly thoughtful in that respect, at the same time trying to honor what the statute requires.
Mm. So, who would bring charges against her or him, if that's the case, if, in fact, this juror did speak out?
Well, that was one thing that they talked about, was that, so there's three statutes involved, and in two of the statutes, McCullough would not have, as I understand the opinion, McCullough would not have himself the ability to charge her. Though that would be up to the St. Louis County Circuit Court to enforce those laws, and they, I guess, could appoint a lawyer to represent that side of the argument. I think on the third statute that potentially he would have the ability to move on that. But again, the court's saying that the grand juror could make statements that achieve her purpose without running afoul of that statute.
Got to take another break. This is moving along very quickly today. We'll do that now. Come back and continue our legal roundtable panel discussion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We have a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court that the court has heard and now considering. I'd like to consolidate these on the issues of time. One is the famous wedding cake case that we have talked about before, the baker who refused to provide cake to a same-sex wedding situation. We've got that. Supreme Court's taking up sports betting. Mark, I'm guessing that's probably one of your favorites. And the travel ban situation has been kicked back downstairs by the Supreme Court. And we have the other case, Mark, that I know you're interested in,
the so-called Carpenter case.
Let's talk about the wedding cake case. So what did we learn from the arguments? Anybody want to pick up on that?
Well, one thing, I mean, the key thing in that case is that almost certainly, I mean, you shouldn't predict Supreme Court outcomes, but I'm going to do it anyway. It seems like Kennedy is the person who's going to decide which way this goes. Kennedy has written all of the Supreme Court opinions relating to gay rights, including same-sex marriage. And clearly believes very deeply about the importance of dignity of same-sex couples and families feeling the dignity of society, equal dignity. But he's also really, you know, he goes to Mass every week, maybe sometimes more than once a week, very devout Catholic. And he feels very strongly also about religion. And so he asked two questions, which point different directions. Well, one is he asked, I think it was the Solicitor General, so could the cake baker, if he wins, could he put up a sign that said, in the window that said, I will not create a wedding cake for a same-sex couple? And basically the Solicitor General said, yeah. Kennedy's also very upset with one of the statements of the Human Relations Commission in Colorado, mm-hmm. which was enforcing this, this ban on discrimination against same-sex marriage. And because one of them said, you know, lots of bad stuff happens as a result of religion. So he sees there being that sort of like a religious animus. Which Justice Kennedy will we end up with? The one who has been the most important advocate of same-sex rights and the dignity of same-sex couples, or this really strong believer in religious freedom?
And either way, it could affect his legacy and how he's viewed by others. Yeah, so it's a big deal. This oral argument was one of the most interesting ones I've ever seen, because first of all, the poor lawyers trying to argue, I mean, literally, they get two sentences into their argument, and then the justices are jumping in with all these questions. They're interrupting each other. There's a lot of discussion you could tell there was a lot of laughter because they're talking about food and, you know, is a chef an artist? Is it cake? And then also the facts that came out, you know, because when I first heard this case, I thought, well, this is kind of a no-brainer. This is no different from the cases where the people in the 50s and 60s refused to serve African Americans, saying, well, my religious right. And there's agreement here by all sides that if a gay couple comes into their store and wants to buy a cake that's already made, they have to sell it. Mm-hmm. And there was also, there seemed to be agreement that a baker, I would not have to make a cake that said, I'm against gay rights, that I wouldn't have to do that. Nobody could force me to do that. But they're clearly, the justices are clearly struggling for what's the test? Where's the speech? How do you divide the speech versus the speech that's going to be assigned to the particular person? You know, there was an example, if Bill wants a cake that says November 9th is the best because that's his anniversary, and then I want it because it commemorates Kristallnacht, as, you know, if you do it for Bill, do you have to do it for me? Really, I mean, really interesting questions. You could tell the justices were interested in this.
Yeah, and it was interesting to hear some of the facts. I didn't get to hear all of them. Mm-hmm. I read some of the syllabuses of the briefs, but it was interesting to me that this defendant here wasn't opposed to selling a gay couple a pre-decorated cake.
No.
He wasn't opposed to having them coming in and buying anything in the store. He just didn't want to write their names. And they hadn't even asked for a message, as I understood it.
Yeah.
They had not asked for a message. They just asked for a decorated cake, and that's where he put his foot down. So, you know, then you wonder, well, where does the religious belief come in? At what point is it sincerely held?
And he may have put his foot down too soon. If a gay couple comes in and I say, I don't do specially designed cakes, and there's nothing distinct about it, that may be then more about who the purchaser is. So,
and an interesting part of the argument was where Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg went through a whole bunch of hypotheticals okay, so who does this apply to? If it applies to a baker, does it apply to the florist? Does it apply to the person who does the bride's nails? What about the person who does her hair?
Yeah.
And, you know, the lawyer for the baker said, doing the hair, that's not really expression. And they said, oh, come on.
That's as artistic as the cake decorator. Yeah.
The First Amendment religious issue, and then the creative freedom.
Right. Compelled speech.
Compelled speech. That's the key.
Right. Yeah. And so they mainly made the argument that the government shouldn't be able to compel the baker to speak in favor of same-sex religion. But when it really got down to where's Kennedy what's inspiring him to think about ruling for the baker? It's actually the religious argument that's got him.
Okay. But this Kinfeld speech is really interesting because that's what's been used. Who's the guy that's Trump's lawyer? Sekulow. Yeah, Sekulow. I mean, he kind of did that when he was doing his religious stuff.
Right.
Less about religion, more about Kinfeld speech. And that can, the justices are very sympathetic to a Kinfeld speech argument.
So far, all of those cases that have pitted religious practices against free speech have come down against the religious practices. The peyote person who wanted to do peyote because it was a religious belief lost.
And that was Justice Scalia.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a whole line of cases there where they've lost. So we'll see if this breaks from the past cases.
The travel ban is on again.
So, yeah. So it's just important to remember, though, that while this may be sort of a tea leaf that the Supreme Court will eventually approve, travel ban 3.0, changed a couple of times, this was on, this is the preliminary stages. We aren't yet to the merits of the case. So both the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals have just had arguments and on the merits. One of them, it talks especially about, is this an establishment of religion, basically a religious ban? The other one, does it violate a 1960s immigration statute that says you can't discriminate against people from a particular country? So those will go up to the Supreme Court on the merits, and we'll see that the Supreme Court could.
But by he included Korea and Venezuela, parts of Venezuela, right? Mm-hmm. So that helps undercut some of their religious argument.
Does that sort of hide the religious?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
it is ultimately going to go back to the Supreme Court.
Yes, it's going to go
no
back.
No question
up.
About
right.
that. Okay. Another case here. We'll go into the weeds on this, but the High Court is considering whether a federal law preventing states from allowing sports betting is constitutional. I know where you stand.
No, I don't like sports betting. I don't like poker. But this is kind of actually, I made my students argue this case because I wanted to find out about it. It's a real snoozer. It's really preemption, which says when the federal government passes laws, the states can't pass laws. Is this law preemption, or is it the 10th Amendment, which doesn't allow the federal government to tell states how to enforce particular laws or what to do? So it's not really that interesting, but it does have pretty broad, or could have pretty broad repercussions. So, but it's a pretty technical area of the law. So
I think it looks like that probably the betting will likely win. Governor Christie says that they'll be able to start taking bets in New Jersey within 2 weeks of the Supreme Court decision. It's expected that 30-plus states will want to get into the business.
There'll be a lot of money at stake.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about, ultimately.
The other side of this is being argued by the sports leagues, and apparently they don't, they don't really, they just soon lose. Well, Nina Totenberg had an interesting, she was sitting near Senator Bradley, used to play for the Knicks, St. Louis kid, Crystal City. So Bradley said one reason he pushed for this law to be passed that limited the betting was when he was playing for the Knicks, he hit a three-pointer at home, and the fans booed. And he said to the other players, what the heck's going on here? Because he had wrecked the spread.
Right. Yeah.
The sports leagues are arguing against it, saying it's going to hurt the integrity of the game. Like there's no sports gambling going on in our country today.
Wait, like there's integrity?
Okay, time is winding down, but I want to get to this Carpenter case before the Supreme Court. It centers on police acquiring cell phone records in a criminal armed robbery case, claiming a Fourth Amendment violation. But what's interesting about this case is the fact that apparently Justices Gorsuch and Alito really went at it during the arguments. Mark, you
familiar? I didn't read the arguments on this one. But I do know this is, I mean, we've talked before about how changing technology is very hard for the courts to keep up with. And they've always taken the view, well, if a third party has the records, you don't have any expectation of privacy. But they've kind of been backing off of that. And here, the issue was what cell towers picked up this guy's cell phone, and it was that third
this
party stuff.
Yeah, this
he's a bank, big bank robber guy.
I mean, it's important to see this as like the third, possibly the third in a series of important privacy cases for the Supreme Court. The first was police have got to have a warrant to put a GPS device on a suspect.
Yeah, that's been dealt with.
That's been dealt with. The Supreme Court said yes. Whether you need to have a warrant to look through a person you just arrested, look through their cell phone. Chief Justice Roberts, yes, cell phone is like a library. It's got everything we ever wanted in it. You got to have a search warrant. Most likely, I think we'll have Chief Justice Roberts again saying that yeah, you got to have a search warrant and throwing out this third party doctrine that if a person has voluntarily given their phone records to the to the phone company, then they have no expectation of privacy anymore. I think that in all these sort of new technology cases, this court, you know, conservative and liberal, is very concerned about the impact of new technology on people's privacy.
Are you familiar with the discussion between Gorsuch and Alito?
No, I missed that.
What were they talking about?
Well, they were both on the same side of this issue, but they were arguing over language, and apparently it caught the attention of a lot of the court observers because these two guys are basically on the same page about everything, but they wonder how that is going to be reflected in future cases.
I do think that a number of the things Gorsuch has done have seemed to be annoying to you know, he just likes asks a lot of questions, and he seems to have been an annoying presence so far.
To Alito?
To a number of the justices on the court.
Well, we've got about another 30 years of them, I guess. So we'll see how that turns out. Okay, in the couple of minutes we have left, let me just bring up this Missouri talc case, which we have tried to talk about for a couple of months now. But the question centers on why these cases, this is Johnson & Johnson and the fact that their talcum powder may cause ovarian cancer. There have been a number of lawsuits. And the question centers on why these cases with out-of-state plaintiffs are filed here in Missouri. Well, Judge Rex Burleson recently ruled the other day, earlier this month, that Missouri does have jurisdiction for cases like this. But my question is, Burleson is the guy who was the judge in the case, and here he is making this ruling. Is that sort of a conflict, it seems to me?
I mean, I just think that his ruling is not really going to go anywhere. It seems to me this one's been decided. So the Supreme Court has made it clear there's got to be a close connection for a person from, say, Alabama to file in Missouri against a New Jersey company.
Which is what's been happening.
Which is what's been happening, right. And so there has to be a closer connection if you're from out of the state and you're going to file away from the home state of the corporation. And so Burleson's saying that there's this union company, Farm Tech Industries, that labels packages and distributes the talcum powder, and that's enough of a connection. I think if anybody who reads the Supreme Court decision, in a different case, would say that that's not enough. And, you know, we have a Missouri Court of Appeals decision, which was written by Lisa Van Amburgh, not exactly, you know, a conservative justice,
right.
Judge, who said, you know, look, the Supreme Court has spoken on this, and there's not a close enough connection between Johnson & Johnson and Missouri for people to be bringing these cases. So I think Burleson is sort of odd man out, but, I mean, who knows?
Why is he making this this decision then?
Well, probably if he was the original judge, it comes back to him. I mean, Lisa Van Amburgh said in that Court of Appeals decision that she rejected the request of the winning plaintiff to have another shot at creating a record of the connection that should justify court jurisdiction. And so Burleson, I guess, is claiming, well, I'm going to give this person the chance to do that. And, you know, like I say, I just think this really isn't that close of a call here.
We're going to have to let it go at that. I'm afraid time is already up. Don Harper, thank you so much for being with us today. It's great to get your expertise on this issue that took so much of our time today. And
well, thank you for having me.
We'll do it again. Bill Freivogel, thank you once again for being with us. Mark Smith,
thank you.
Always a pleasure to see you all. Thank you so very much. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.